This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
So it's going to rain hard, maybe, tonight and into tomorrow, maybe, and maybe 8 to 10 inches of rain, maybe, maybe not. It's the time of year, you know, early May, where we get these torrential 1-in-100-year rain events, and we've had some problems in the past. So we'll let you know everything you need to know here at WWL. We'll talk with Steve Nelson later on with the Sewage and Water Board, also Barry Keim, LSU climatologist. But the only thing I can tell you is they got some unstable weather, and it could lead to some heavy rain, or maybe it won't, and they don't know. So there you go. Andy Smith joins us now. I know a lot of y'all love Andy Smith. I do too, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. How you doing, Andy Smith?
I'm doing great. And you?
I'm all right. We had a good meeting of the Andy Smith fan club last week. A lot of people showed up.
Both of us.
Yeah, they brought the Angela brought the smothered potatoes, which we really love. So that was a nice covered dish that we had. Anyway, seriously, let's talk about President Trump, because one thing I thought of when and I asked people to text in before their thoughts on President Trump. Somebody said Trump and staff doing a great job. Somebody else said, Tommy, I don't feel like I don't watch that many foreign films. I don't know what that means. Eggs are cheaper. Gas is cheaper. About the tariffs. Stock market's not that far off. Other than the threats of on national news, I'm not that affected. I would like to buy Trump for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth. I detest him. We didn't have much of a choice with the presidential election. Somebody else said DOJ is settling with the family of the rioter killed by Capitol Police. Trump met with Proud Boy and Rico and Mom at Mar-a-Lago this weekend. So corrupt and traitor to the U.S. should have been hung on Pence's gallows on January 7th. So apparently that's a very strong feeling about President Trump. He's not a man that about which you can be ambivalent, really, is he?
Yeah, nobody really just shrugs their shoulders about Trump, no. I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Love him or hate him, and a lot of that's just driven by your party and where you get your news from.
Now, a lot of people, you know, I don't buy into the Trump derangement syndrome thing. I think that was brilliant of him to come up with that, because basically, mm-hmm. It means if you criticize Trump, then you've got Trump derangement syndrome. But it does seem as though, you know, if you look at Meet the Press, I don't know if I have to follow the Constitution. He's either playing around or he's crazy. I think he's playing around. I don't think he's crazy when he just says things to try to shock us. I know that might seem like a surprise to people, but I think he says things to shock us and try to get attention. Do you think I'm wrong?
I think there's a lot of that he does, a lot of that trolling. But a lot of it also is that it's just his way of speaking and not really answering a question directly, mm-hmm. allows for so much interpretation by somebody who has ill intent, shall we say. So when he was saying, should I follow the Constitution, I think a lot of that was, you know, my lawyers are arguing about some things or some disagreements over things. You know, I don't know what the answer is. So I don't want to be defending him, really, but no, it's just after watching him for years, he's not very clear in how he speaks.
Well, and it's interesting techniques that he uses, too. Like, he'll, you know, if a reporter corners him, he'll say, well, you're not being very nice. I don't know who you right. are. He'll attack the reporter himself. The president does have a knack of saying some things like gas being $1.98 a gallon, which I don't know where he got that from, but it doesn't matter, because for people that love him, It's truth, right?
That is one of the things that we've been seeing, and it's become, it's not just for Trump, it's for Biden as well. But the partisanship is really what's driving all of this. You know, you're rooting for your team. You know, it's like my country, good or bad, or like my mother, mm-hmm. drunk or sober. That's where we've gotten with politics now, is that there's not a clear set of facts that people are willing to accept. There's not clear interpretations of world events that they're willing to accept. It's all being driven by politics, and, you know, the parties are loving it.
Well, somebody texted in, Tommy, great leaders are often what we call disruptors. Well, that's true, and that statement, just on the face of it, you know, I could turn it around and say, you know, some leaders that have been disruptors have not been so great either. But people tend to see it through the prism of what they want to see. And when it comes to Trump's approval rating, I'm looking at a headline here from a story. It says Trump's approval rating is low, but good luck finding those who regret their vote. Let's take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I know there are some people that in my neighborhood that are staunch Trump supporters and flag flyers and so forth. Not U.S. flags, but Trump flags. And I know that his policies are hurting them, but I know also that there is no way they're going to say that they have any buyer's remorse. And it's not just about Trump or them. It's about human beings being able to or willing to admit they made a mistake. And I'm not saying they necessarily did or they feel that way. But generally speaking, human beings don't want to say that I was wrong or I made a mistake, if in fact they would be. Andy Smith, our guest, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. What do you think about President Trump? 504-260-1870. Somebody texted in, I'm a take him or leave him guy on Trump. I voted for him, but would have happily voted for a better option had we been offered one. And just like Andy said, it's like it's so much about winning or losing, you lose sight of the fact that maybe we could do something better than either side. 621 traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, about President Trump's approval ratings. But yet, when it comes to people that have voted for him, you're not going to find a lot of people that regret their vote. And somebody texted in, not voting for Harris, a mistake. Are you kidding me? And that's, Andy, goes to what you said, where people frame it as like a win-loss kind of thing, where, well, both Harris and Trump can suck in a world, if that's the way you think, but it doesn't have to be one's bad that making the other one good, right?
Exactly. And then over the last three presidential elections, we saw that neither candidate had high favorability ratings going into the election. Both in 2016, 2020, and 2024, each time they were the two least liked presidential candidates in history. And then they broke each other's records year after or election after election. But that didn't stop people from saying, well, my skunk is better than your, my party skunk is better than your party skunk. And they, you know, you end up going down the list of tiebreakers almost and decide which candidate you're going to vote for, because neither of them, frankly, none of the candidates have been second comings of Winston Churchill.
But when you get right down to it, it does ultimately default to red or blue, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's something that has been increasing in the United States going back at least until the 1960s and 70s, really accelerated by the 1990s and 2000s. We don't have the ideological broadness of the parties that we used to have. And we're in another shift right now. The old conservative Republican Party, small government, free trade, that sort of stuff, that's going away because Trump's remaking this party into something different. And it's becoming, it's kind of like we're seeing the base of America, the middle of America, the blue collar voters and the middle class voters shifting from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is taking over those positions, and the Democratic Party is becoming the elite party. So it's we're seeing kind of a sociological shift within the parties rather than the political makeup. And that makes it easy for people to look at the other party with scorn. They're either pointy headed intellectuals or they're, you know, knuckle draggers over there on the other side.
I wonder. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Andy.
No, go finish up.
I was just going to say, I wonder what the future portends here, because does that give the Democrats an opportunity? Or when it comes to what the Republicans are, I thought Republicans were for smaller government, and they seem to be, unless it's government in control of what I want the government to be in control of, or taxes to tax whatever I want, and him and not you. You understand what I'm saying?
There's the rub. You're looking for ideological consistency, and I don't think you're going to find much in politics today.
Does that change going forward, or is this the new normal?
I think it's the new normal because, frankly, our national government over the last 100 years has really been able to offer benefits to each small group of people in the country. So everybody's got a little piece of the pie, and the parties want to reward the people that are their supporters and punish the other folks. But there are enough goodies to go around that everybody likes to buy the votes that they need to get elected.
I like to lessen anxiety. So for people that are just, you know, their hair is on fire about President Trump, do you see a difference between him and President Trump from 2016 or Donald Trump from 35 years ago? Because I don't.
I don't see too much difference other than shortness of time, understanding that things are going to end quickly.
But in terms of personality, for people that are all flipping out and everything, I don't see any difference. And he's always been, right? When somebody shows you who they are, believe them?
I think so. You can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Actually, I think you can sometimes if you use enough treats. Thank you, Andy. Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. I got a new dog, and I'm trying to figure out how to train him because I think he's got some border collie in him, and I think he wants to work. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Barry Irwin, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for Better Louisiana, on how things are going in the legislative session up in Baton Rouge. Right now, we pause for WWL First News. May 3rd, May 5th, you name it, it can be a tough time of year. Barry Irwin joins us now, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for a Better Louisiana. How you doing, Barry?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. So I'm looking at a post here from Julie O'Donoghue, a reporter for the Louisiana Illuminator. She says on Twitter, the Louisiana House just voted unanimously for a major rewrite of the state ethics laws pushed by Governor Jeff Landry. No lawmaker got up to ask a single question. The ethics board staff expressed many concerns about the bill Friday. Then her story says, while facing ethics charges, Landry pushes overhaul of investigation process. That's a big overview. Maybe you can give us the details on what's going on, Barry, and your thoughts?
Yeah, well, it is a big rewrite of the ethics legislation, and it really goes from top to bottom. I mean, I think the thing that really concerned us, and we spoke out about it, was what it really does is make it almost impossible for, you know, the ethics board to really investigate folks. And, you know, I won't say to get a conviction or to find somebody, you know, at fault, but it really raises the bar a lot. And so, you know, almost everything requires a 2/3 vote just to begin an investigation. You know, there are other considerations that are put in there. It gives legislators a lot more ability to do things like with trips and, you know, entertainment and those types of things. So I don't know. You know, my feeling is we had this period under Bobby Jindal where we wanted to have the gold standard of, you know, ethics and number one in ethics. And, you know, I guess we just got tired of that. And so we don't feel that way anymore.
So what could be the effects of this, I guess? What could that look like, Barry, the new, if this passes as proposed, this law? What could people do maybe and not be subject to review or not be investigated for?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you kind of worry about is, you know, there are violations. Let's not be, you know, it's not big in the news all the time, but it does happen that there are violations of things. And a lot of them have to do with, you know, family things, nepotism-related things, or hires that are inappropriate for a lot of reasons. You know, it's not the end-of-the-world thing, but there are things that we don't want to happen. And there are the things that erode confidence that people have in government and in government officials and in our political leaders. So we need to have these things in place so that, you know, we can maintain that confidence. What I fear that will happen is that people will be, you know, kind of much more lax with trying to pay attention to some of these things. You know, accepting kind of gifts or things that they shouldn't be accepting from people who should not be giving them to them because they're doing business with the entity or whatever it is like that. And it just becomes more of a way of life of accepting these things because it will be so hard for the ethics board to actually get the votes, you know, to make a conviction and that type of thing.
And let me be clear about this. I just try to call balls and strikes, okay? So when it comes to, on one hand, we're saying that we want to make the business, the state more business-friendly. We want to attract new businesses. We want to change tax code. We want to do this. We want to do that. It would seem to me Louisiana long had a reputation of, you know, it's bad in a lot of places, but in Louisiana, the bribery, the corruption is really bad. It would seem to me like if you're trying to attract new businesses and you're trying to change the business climate in Louisiana, that it's disingenuous to loosen ethics laws while you're trying to do that, if you're going to attract new businesses. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, let's be honest. This probably is going to be on the radar for a little while here, and then it's probably going to go away. I mean, kind of what happened, if you remember back in the Jindal thing, they made a big deal about it. We said, look, this is part of our reputation. It's not a good part of our reputation, and we're going to go try and do some things to fix it, and did some things to move up into the rankings. Honestly, it rankled a lot of the legislators. They've always kind of had, you know, a spot of, you know, angst about having to do some of the things they have to do. And finally, I think the pendulum has swung back. But, you know, you're right. I don't think it looks great in the headlines for us to have some of the issues that we have and then say, oh, yeah, and we're going backwards on ethics laws. Mm,
that's the only point I was trying to make. Let me take a break. We come back. We'll talk about disclosure, I guess, as far as something else the governor's pushing for to shield campaign spending on constitutional amendments, which is odd because the governor accused George Soros of tanking his March ballot initiative, but now he wants to make it harder to determine, as I understand it, who's paying for what ad against what proposal. We'll talk about that and other things as well with the session when we come back with Barry Irwin, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders for Better Louisiana. Oconheart Jeweler text me lines open at 504-260-1870. If you have any questions or comments, 650, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Governor's pushing for an overhaul of ethics investigation processes, and while he's facing some ethics charges, and we while we talk about building a better business climate, it would seem as though making sure that public officials were subject to scrutiny and weren't on the take, and I'm not implying anything here for anybody, but just in terms of it just seems contradictory to say we're going to change a tax structure to make it business friendly here, but yet we're going to make it a little bit harder to find out what's going on over there with politicians and who has influence. Along those lines, Barry Irwin, Chief Policy Officer for Leaders of a Better Louisiana, is with us. They're talking about shielding campaign spending on constitutional amendments and tax proposals, which is interesting because the governor, after he got his rear end handed to him on a ballot with his March proposals, blame George Soros for putting money behind this, but this would actually make it more difficult to determine who's paying for what, right?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I don't get this at all. I mean, there's a full, complete campaign finance overhaul, which you can sort of understand. You may disagree or agree or disagree, but you can understand what they're doing. This I do not understand. I mean, it just seems like basic, you know, freedom of whatever that people should know. When these ballots are, and measures are on the ballot, keep in mind, a lot of these are tax measures, the things that are important. A lot of them are constitutional amendments that deal with things that are, you know, big deals in our state. We ought to be able to know who is kind of pushing for or against some of these things. It's just, you know, common sense. I don't understand this, but it's not a good step in the right direction.
And even at that, Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, but what, you know, if it carries the disclaimer paid for by, you still need to do some research to see who the hell paid for it by is, right?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. You don't know who it is. There are these different things with various PACs. And you know, they can already do this to some degree already. But, yeah, they don't have to disclose who's behind it. So you got to name, you know, Citizens for Good Stuff, but you don't know who that is. And that just, you know, transparency is, to me, always the solution to so many of the problems that we have. But if we're taking away transparency, that's just really a step in the wrong direction.
And there's no doubt that these things we're talking about would take away transparency, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we don't want to try and prevent everybody from doing everything. Certainly there's freedom of speech, there's freedom of expression, freedom for people to contribute to causes that they believe in. That's fine and good. we probably have too much money in the system, and we're probably going to be adding more with it. But at least if we have transparency, you and I can look and see where the money's coming from. We can see if we agree or disagree with that source. It can help us make decisions about things that we do have to decide. And when we don't have that transparency, it just makes it harder for all of us.
And when it comes to relocating businesses, companies don't want to have to bribe officials, correct? They want an even playing field?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that's of interest to me is I would think, you know, businesses don't want to cross the legislature or a governor, political people. I get that. But on the other hand, it's kind of sending a message to businesses, you know, bring your money and we're going to be going into your pockets.
Yep. I got you. Thank you, Barry. All right, here we go. 7:14, Tuesday, May 6th, a tough time of year when it comes to rain. Barry Keim joins us now, LSU climatologist, talk about hurricane preparedness week. But first, let's talk about this weather that is forecast to come in. And what is it about this time of year, Barry, that makes it so prone? You know, I'm thinking of May 3rd floods. We had a couple of them, May 5th, May 6th. You pick the time of year, Cedric Grant's flood. What is it about this time of year?
Yeah, there was absolutely something about the, you know, the late April, early May time frame that the atmosphere can just come together and throw some of the heaviest rainfall that we've ever seen in this area. It just puts it all together and bam. I wish I knew the answer to that, Tommy. I really don't know, to be perfectly frank. I mean, obviously, this is the time of year when the frontal systems are pretty strong as we're transitioning into the summer season. We still get some pretty cold air from the north moving down here, but now, you know, things are really starting to heat up down here, and we can get a very, very unstable atmosphere, you know, as we get into the spring. I guess one argument would be, Tommy, is that the upper atmosphere is still relatively cold coming out of the winter season, but the surface temperatures really start to heat up as we start getting into, you know, late spring and start looking at summer. And that creates a very, very unstable vertical profile of the atmosphere, which it just makes it that much easier to pop off thunderstorms. And, of course, if you're popping off thunderstorms, there's, you know, the potential to produce some heavy rains. But, yeah, we've had some doozies in at this time of year, for sure. May 3rd, May 8th. 1998, that was another one. So, yeah, we've had some big ones.
Is there a difference between climatologist and meteorologist?
Of course. You know, meteorology is the short-term forecasting of the weather. It's really the physics of the atmosphere. Climate basically does everything else, you know, looking at long-term impacts, long-term changes, and, you know, and averages. And, of course, those, when I say averages, that could be average return frequencies of hurricanes. So it basically incorporates almost everything else. Now, when you talk about a 50- or 100-year storm, I would argue that's climatology. That's not really meteorology. Meteorology is really just about the forecasting of the weather and how it's going to change over the next hour up to the next few days.
And that was my next question about 100-year storm events, because it seems as though starting back on May 3rd, and I forgot what year it was, in the 70s or whatever, it seems like that was the first one-in-100-year flood event, and it would seem as though I don't know if it's because the climate is changing. I don't know what's going on, but it seems as though the dam, pardon the pun, burst then, and then from then on we started to get these every 100-year, once-in-a-year rainfalls. Is it about the nomenclature that's confusing there, or tell me, Barry?
No, you're absolutely correct. You know, just by dumb luck, Tommy, I did my master's thesis on heavy rainfalls in New Orleans.
And I
looked at this temporally just to see, you know, because this was in the 90s. We'd had May 3rd and some other really, really big rainstorms across the region. And it's like, is this normal? Or, I mean, let's look at the long-term record and see if there's something unusual going on. And you're absolutely correct. That May 3rd, 1978 storm started us into a new regime, a period where these big rainstorms have become way more common. And you're absolutely correct. And these 25, 50, and 100-year storms are occurring with regularity that makes no sense. Now, what's interesting, though, is like the previous 30 or 40 years, we didn't get very many heavy rainfalls. In the 50s, 60s, early 70s was a time when, you know, we barely had storms over 5 inches in that window of time. And, that, you know, it sort of, I guess it just lulled us into thinking we don't get those big storms. And then in 78, the switch just flicked in the other direction, and all hell has been breaking loose ever since.
Well, it's good to know that that is proven out by facts and not just my own perception, because that's certainly the way that it seemed. So when it comes to, and real quick before we get to the break, and we'll take the break, and then we'll come back, talk about hurricane preparedness. How concerned are you about whatever it is that's coming this way with the weather and the flood watch and all of that?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a dangerous situation, obviously. We'll just have to wait and see how it all officially plays out. But we're looking at widespread rains across the state of Louisiana of 3 to 5 inches. There could absolutely be some areas that see even more. I mean, this potential weather service, I saw some numbers even up to 10 inches in certain locations. I'm sure that'll just be some isolated pockets. But, this could really wreak havoc across this region. So we need to be on our A game for the next couple of days.
Somebody texted in, April showers bring May flowers. Yeah, it's not the April showers I'm worried about. It's the May showers I'm worried about that bring streets flooding and so forth. We're talking to Barry Keim, LSU climatologist. It's Hurricane Preparedness Week. We come back, we'll talk about cuts to NOAA. I see a tweet here from Neil deGrasse Tyson, whom we had on one time, saying weather and climate research funds are being chainsawed from NOAA's budget. So we'll talk about that and more, and the likelihood that the prediction by the NOAA of hurricanes or path or whatever could be, and safety of the area could be affected by cuts, with Barry Keim when we come back. Right now, 7:20, time for traffic, WWL. 7:25, Tuesday, May 6th. And it's the time of year where we're known for some heavy rainfall. Some of that's predicted between 7 o'clock tonight and 7 o'clock tomorrow night, I think, is the most anticipated period for that. Barry Keim, LSU climatologist, with us. Talk about Hurricane Preparedness Week. When it comes to the NOAA cuts, and I mentioned a tweet by Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, earlier about weather and climate research funds chainsawed from NOAA's budget. What are you hearing, Barry, and what is there going to be any palpable change, things that were available last year, not available this year, or are cuts going to really matter?
Well, the cuts are going to matter, certainly in the long term. We may not notice it in a big way this year, but maybe. We'll see. I mean, NOAA is basically cutting about 25 or 30% of its budget. And it's not going to be evenly distributed, across NOAA. I mean, the research labs, forecast modeling, data acquisition, those areas are going to get hit particularly hard. And that is going to show up eventually in the accuracy of the forecasts and the ability to inform the public about what's actually happening. So there are definitely some issues on the horizon. And, obviously we just have to see how it all plays out. Just to give you a couple of examples, the pilots who fly the hurricane hunting airplanes, I believe they went from 10 pilots down to 7. Mm-hmm. So not a big deal, but let's just hope nobody gets sick during hurricane season. Because, as they're, sending people out and doing rotations, that could be a big problem.
When you look at the federal budget and how much money we spend, and I know you got to start somewhere, but it seems kind of silly when you look at what the hurricane hunter pilots, the specialized skill that they have and the information that they provide, it seems kind of silly to lay off a couple of them. Yes, no?
I agree totally. it's a big deal, and like I said, and they're hitting all the research labs where this is where the innovation happens to improve the forecast. I mean, you may have noticed some of us have noticed over the last several decades that the forecasting is getting better and better. We're able to predict landfall with much greater accuracy today than even, 15, 20 years ago. And even the intensity forecasts, while, we're lagging behind in some regards, the intensity forecasts are getting better and better, where we can predict rapid intensification of storms and things of that nature. They're doing some amazing things, with hurricane forecasting and forecasting in general, but this is just going to slow us down by crippling all the research labs that have created all that innovation and would, have, more innovation moving forward. And then another issue, this is going to be a big issue even going into this season, is that they're putting out all these early retirements and inducing, paying people basically to retire early. But there's also a hiring freeze on. So the National Weather Service offices around the country, and in particular the ones along the Gulf Coast, Some are hit harder than others. I mean, the Baton Rouge, New Orleans office that covers, you know, the Mississippi Gulf Coast, the attrition rate was pretty low there, so we're not going to be affected in any big way. The Lake Charles office, which oversees southwestern Louisiana, they've been hit pretty hard, and so they're grossly understaffed. And then over in Houston, the Houston office has been decimated, and of course there's a hiring freeze in place, so they can't replace any of these people. So going into hurricane season, you know, that whole Houston region, and there's a lot of people there. They're basically in harm's way without a whole lot of infrastructure there in place to help inform, you know, which hospitals should evacuate if things start coming unraveled. So
this would manifest
some big issues, I think, that could happen this year.
Manifest itself as well with evacuations, Barry, and notice and so forth.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
What evacuations? Where officials trying to call an evacuation or not, knowing about intensification or path, et cetera, it could affect that directly this year.
Absolutely. In places like Houston, not so much here in the New Orleans area, but like I said, the Lake Charles region will be understaffed, and Houston is just decimated. So, and there's no way to hire people back right now to try and fill those positions. So there are definitely some problems around the Gulf Coast like that.
All right. Thank you, Barry. Let's hope it's a quiet hurricane season. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member, about the homeless situation, surge in water board, and more right now. Time for WWL First News. 7:47, 13 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It is Give NOLA Day. And, you know, I'm a big fan of givinghopenola.org if you want to volunteer, or donate, make a donation. And also Unbranded is an organization that I've been involved with, and it's a physical therapist that removes tattoos from victims of sex trafficking. You can go to unbranded.org. A lot of good causes. Main thing is give something today if you can. After getting off the phone with Peyton Malone just now, WWL Louisiana forecaster, main threat is this evening after 7 or 8 o'clock. You might have a shower or two this afternoon, but really the heavy rain comes in overnight. There is a definite flood risk. I've not seen anything from NOLA.com, but I'm sure they're going to allow neutral ground parking, you would think, although that's not been approved yet. And it all depends on the conditions are favorable for these storms to train and park over an area. But the problem is, you don't know if it's going to be East Bank, West Bank, North Shore, all of the above, none of the above. So there is a flood risk. And tomorrow morning, this is going to mostly happen overnight while everybody's sleeping. Not me, because I get up at 3. But for most of y'all, so check with WWL, check with Dave Cohen, the early edition of WWL First News or TV or whatever you want to do before you head out so you know what streets are involved and what streets aren't. A couple of things making news in the NFL. The Baltimore Ravens have released Justin Tucker. Some people think he's the most successful, best kicker ever in the history of the NFL. He's an opera singer, and he sings for his church. But there have been some charges about him akin to the Deshaun Watson stuff with massage therapist, and I'll leave it at that. And then there's something about Travis Hunter that I found interesting on social media. He plays for the Jaguars. He kind of plays both ways. He plays cornerback, plays wide receiver, and he's on social media. His fiance gave him a $30,000 watch, and he said, "That's fine, but I'd rather have a boat." So I thought I'd open the Oakenhart Jeweler text me line here at 504-260-1870. Would you rather have a boat or an expensive piece of jewelry or maybe a nice car or whatever, $35,000, let's say? Do you want a boat or do you want a nice piece of jewelry? And we were going to talk to Eugene Green, having a little bit of trouble connecting with him. My intuition never lets me down. Oh, apparently he is there. So let me take a break. We'll pick it up with Eugene Green when we come back. 7:50, 10 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. Now, let me tell you about Kronos BHW. It's a kind of long story, so bear with me. They're on North Arnold, right by Drago's, and it's Dr. Mace Scott and his team. And what they do is they provide body health and wellness. It's like a one-stop operation. And when it comes to hormone replacement therapy, a lot of people are starting to get into that, but you got to be careful who you see for that. That's why it's a good idea to see a medical doctor like Dr. Scott. He and his team go beyond just the basics with ongoing support, follow-up visits, and even nutrition and fitness needs. Now, I've lost over 100 pounds. That has changed my life. But now I'm starting some hormone therapy because I have low testosterone. And guys, if you're feeling stressed or not quite yourself, it could be low testosterone. And men start to lose free testosterone at the age of 30. It can affect your energy, your mood, even your drive. But Kronos has a solution. Kronos Body Health and Wellness specializes in hormone replacement therapy. I'm going over there today as soon as I get off, with a personalized approach to boost energy, strength, and vitality. You're going to experience improved mood, increased muscle mass, better focus and performance. It's going to bring the you back that you've missed, that you thought was gone forever. But you know what? Dr. Scott's going to work with you to create a custom plan for your needs to restore balance so you can feel strong and productive again. I can't say enough about it. Don't wait to feel like yourself again. Whether it's weight loss or hormone replacement therapy, go to Kronos, C-H-R-O-N-O-S, C-H-R-O-N-O-S-B-H-W.com, C-H-R-O-N-O-S-B-H-W.com. And take the first step today. You're not going to regret it. All right, 7:55 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council Member. How you doing, Council Member Green?
Good morning. How are you doing, Tommy?
Okay, sir. Let's talk about the surge. Let's talk about the surge in water board real quick. I know you talked about an inch an hour, a half an inch thereafter, and you talked to Steve Nelson, and basically I think he gave you the answer that any contractor would. We can do anything you want if you got the money. Tell me how confident you are that the surge in water board will be able to take care of whatever rain we have coming today.
Well, I just want everybody to know that we certainly will always need more resources to get more things done. Mm-hmm. The sewage and water board pumps, we want them to all be working. Most of the time, 90% of them are working. It's just that when you have rain that comes down in such an intense fashion at certain times, such as we had earlier, well, later in April, the bottom line is that it's hard. It's difficult for the pumps to keep up, or it's impossible beyond an inch. And I want people to know what an inch means. If you look at the entire city where all the water is, for example, it's saying that those pumps are taking water down in all of the various neighborhoods at the rate of an inch an hour. Doesn't seem like it's a lot, but it's not exactly in front of just one or two places, in front of thousands of residences and in the streets of in many blocks. So the bottom line is that I wish that we could do more. We're building a power station that's going to provide more stable electricity so that pumps don't go out. The bottom line is that there are some things that we can do also, but I want you to know that nobody is ignoring flooding, that we recognize the need to address flooding, and that we hope to be able to work with the state, because the Sewage and Water Board is actually a state institution, but that's a discussion for maybe an ongoing fashion. But the bottom line is that I think that we're confident that the pumps will be working to the maximum extent possible and that we will get that water out of the streets.
You know, I was talking to Scott Walker yesterday, your fellow council member in Jefferson Parish, and he made a good point about the water being in the street. And you got to remember that if it's in the street, it's not in the houses. And sometimes when you get a torrential rainfall, that's just going to happen, right?
Well, I'm glad that it's not been going into the houses. I was there in the Ninth Ward, for example, during the last storm, and I was afraid that some of the water was going to get into houses. It didn't. It got into some cars, and that's never acceptable. And I want everybody to know, as you're listening, it's not acceptable for there to be flooding in any place. But it is important to recognize that we're in a city that's below sea level. Some areas are lower than other areas. We have certainly storm drains. Yeah, those storm drains do get clogged. We do have pumps, and yes, sometimes those pumps go out. But the bottom line is that, in reality, as we look at New Orleans and we look at the metropolitan area, a tremendous job is done taking water out of an area that in some places is a bowl. So we have to recognize that there are always going to be challenges. We want people to be prepared, move your vehicles to higher levels, recognize that nobody is saying that we want to ignore anything, and that the pumps are always on. That's what I want people to say, too. Once there's enough water inside the system for the pumps to work, they come on. If they go out, maybe it's because of electricity, but no one's sitting around saying, we're not going to turn on the pumps. The pumps are always turned on. But the bottom line is that we need more support, if you will.
We need even support from residents, recognizing that we have 70,000 storm drains in New Orleans alone. If you can help that storm drain outside of your house, if you can get those leaves from in front of it and that debris from in front of it, it does help the water to get into it, and it does make a difference in certain communities. But we're never going to ignore flooding and the potential for flooding. We're always addressing it and always providing resources and information to people.
Thank you, Eugene Green. Appreciate it. New Orleans City Council member, to what he said, if you can, keep in mind, if the water doesn't get into the drain, it doesn't go into the canal and it can't be pumped out. So if you can today safely make sure that you got any oak leaves or anything else picked up and the drain is clear so that the water can get in and then it can go into the canal and then it can be pumped and you get it. We'll talk to Troy Hebert, Louisiana State Representative, when we come back. Then Steve Nelson with the Surge and Water Board. A lot coming up. Stay with us. 8:15 now, waiting for the rain this evening. Starts around 7 or 8 and could be maybe street flooding situations. It all depends on where the showers park. They can't tell you where, but just give you a time frame on it. So before you leave the house tomorrow, you might want to check to see what's going on so you don't drive into a flooded street and flood your car. You don't want that to happen. State Representative Troy Hebert joins us now to talk about what's going on in the session. How you doing, Representative?
Good morning.
Thanks for taking.
How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. Tell me, what's got your attention, some of the bills that you've filed, and is it all about insurance?
I would say, majority of my bills filed in this session were in insurance. As we've discussed before, I did get off the House floor. It moved the fortified roof program for the Department of Insurance to the Senate. I have a bill coming up this week in the Senate. It's a lapse in coverage bill. Mm-hmm. Basically, that bill on the insurance side doesn't allow insurance companies to do rate hikes on your first lapse in coverage of your insurance, meaning, I don't know, you might have forgot to pay. Maybe you went to boot camp, didn't realize you were supposed to turn in your plate, report your plate that your car was parked all that time. And then when you came back and tried to get insurance on your vehicle, you could have had anywhere from a 16% to 20% or maybe even higher rate hike. So we put a bill in place that works with insurance, and basically it doesn't allow them to do any rate hikes on your first lapse in coverage, which a lot of people have been sending in emails thanking us for running this bill because there are a lot of life events that happen. Mm-hmm. However, this bill also doesn't promote not driving with insurance. So if the individual 5 or more years doesn't lapse in coverage and they have another life event that may cause them to lapse in coverage, well, then the insurance companies will get like a repeat, we'll call it, and you'll avoid a rate hike again in that next lapse in coverage. So I think it's a good consumer protection bill. I do have a bill on the insurance reform package, capping contingency fees on attorneys at 10% on the first $15,000. However,
Wait, say that part again.
You have your minimum coverage of $15,000. Mm-hmm. In all your auto insurance, we are putting a fee to cap the first $15,000. Instead of getting, I don't know, 30-40% on the first $15,000, they would get 10%. But currently, right now, I'm working with individuals to see if we can put that bill in a better place. So I'm kind of keeping that bill parked for a minute while we're having more conversations on it. We passed one off the floor last night. Workforce Commission has a unemployment portal where businesses can report to the portal if they believe someone is on unemployment benefits and they maybe didn't show up for interviews or not meeting all work search criteria that they're supposed to gain their benefits. There's a portal that's been out there on the Workforce Commission for a year now that people can report. And it allows a business can report if someone didn't show up for an interview. And because they may believe that individual just scheduled the interview and didn't show up because to meet a unemployment benefits requirement. What we did yesterday on the floor was we codified and we kept that portal in place permanently, and we increased work search criteria from 3 events a week to 5. Did that on behalf of the Louisiana Workforce Commission. And then I have another bill which gained a lot of attention in the New Orleans market. It's called the Restaurant Reservation Bill, where AI bots on various on reservation sites were actually going on restaurant websites and taking up all the restaurant reservations unknown to the actual restaurant owner.
Mm-hmm.
And then turning around and reselling those reservations for profit, and without the restaurant owner knowing. And so basically we didn't block that business model. All we did in the bill that's also left the House is we're just requiring anyone who is going to take these type of reservations on behalf of the business owner, the restaurant, that they have to have a written agreement like just about any other reservation site out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's turned into a pretty interesting bill. Other states have kind of moved on this legislation as well. I think the biggest part of the story on this bill was during the Super Bowl, someone paid, I think it was $2,100 or $2,200 to get a 4-top reservation at Antoine's.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just all we're trying to do in this bill is make sure that the restaurants know what's going on. They understand that these people are profiting off of their restaurant, their hard work, and if they're going to do those type of reservation sites, they just have a written agreement with the restaurant owner. So insurance, unemployment, working with business community, I'm kind of all over the board in this session.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. I know I'm glad what you're doing about the reservations. I got screwed over on Paul Simon tickets where I bought them from a secondary buyer. I didn't realize that and paid double the price of the tickets and didn't realize it until I claimed them. So I don't know if there's anything we can do about that or not. 822 traffic now, WWL. 826 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Representative Troy Hebert talking about the session and about insurance. When it comes to the automobile insurance, exorbitant rates and the dust-up with the trial attorneys, and it's them, no, it's them, no, it's them, no, it's them, what hope can you give anybody, Representative, that anything's going to be done either with tort reform or some meaningful change that's going to put us more on a par with Mississippi or Texas when it comes to car insurance?
Yeah, listen, when I got elected, one of the things that I ran on was coming as a real estate professional and broker and then real estate investor. We started watching the rising cost of home insurance, how it started to affect even deals being put together. You know, the rising interest rates on top of rising costs of insurance were starting to become obstacles for people to purchase homes. We start to see that again to the investor market as well. And then it just troubled in from that point of view, that point. And so I actually asked the speaker if I could be put on the insurance committee, which, you know, I'm sure many people were trying to avoid that committee.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe it's the number one problem in the state of Louisiana by far. It's the problem that you hear the most from constituents. You knock on doors, you go say hello, you go introduce yourself. People are suffering, people are hurting. After the last regular session, we had 5 months of insurance hearings where you had business owners, people, just general constituents. You had doctors, lawyers, everyone coming talk about all the different facets of how rising costs of insurance is affecting them. So we put together a package of bills, and we passed 16 insurance bills out of the House of Representatives in this fiscal session. All 16 bills are now on the Senate side. They range from property and casualty, like the Fortified Roof Program, to help lower insurance rates. There's tort reform bills in there. There are consumer-friendly bills on the insurance side in there as well. I think we just decided that we had to do something. Constituents are calling. They're telling us that they want tort reform. They are asking for something to be done in that nature. There are many bills in that 16 that I guess we can call that address the tort-related scenario. Not that I would say that insurance companies are angels at the same time, but I do believe that if a good bit of these bills come across the Senate and make it to the governor's desk and are signed, I do believe that there's some proven litigation out there in other states that that do help and assist in lowering rates.
Right.
So we're going to give it a shot.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your time, Representative Troy Hebert. We'll come back, talk to Steve Nelson, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board, talk about the rain that's coming. And I'm going to tell you something that happened at the Colosseum in Rome, an American tourist. I don't think you're going to want to do this. We'll tell you when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talked to Peyton Malone about an hour ago. He says after 7, 8 o'clock tonight and overnight, there could be showers that park themselves or training effect, however you want to say it. Maybe 8 inches of rain in one area, maybe in another. How do you handle all of that if you're pumping out the city of New Orleans? Steve Nelson joins us now, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board of New Orleans. It's just as easy as flipping the switch and getting the water out, right, Steve? No.
Would that were the case, Tommy.
Let's take it from the beginning if we can, because I think with all the oak trees that we have and all of the pecan trees now that are bleeding, these little fuzzy things are shedding, whatever you want to call it. How important is it that people today, if they can safely get out and just make sure that the drain is clear so the water can get in the drain? Because if the water can't get in the drain, you're not accomplishing anything, are you?
Yeah, well, you touched on an important point, and this talking point's probably been repeated about 500 times over the last 48 hours, but we can handle 1 inch of rain in that first hour and a half inch every hour thereafter, and that refers to the system as a whole. It's not just the pumps, and it starts with the catch basins and the lateral lines, and as you mentioned, if we can start by clearing trash and debris, if we notice leaves or garbage or grass clippings in front of our catch basins, we can start by clearing those and then the smaller diameter lines. And that's just the front of the catch basin. No need to go into it. Just clear what's out front.
Because of the leaf debris and so forth and all that stuff that accumulates, right?
Yep, that's right. If the catch basin's, if the front of it's clogged and the water can't get to it, then obviously it can't get down the lateral pipe into the canal or even to our pumps.
And along those lines, I always like to keep it simple, stupid, as they say. So I guess you don't want people putting their garbage out tonight either, right? Because those cans get dumped over and then the stuff clogs the drains. And if it doesn't get to the drain, then again, you're not accomplishing anything.
Yeah, that's a great point. Mentioned that yesterday as well. Be aware of where we put our trash cans. If we can exercise some caution. My trash pickup is Wednesday morning as well, so I'm going to be putting my trash cans a little bit higher up on the sidewalk so folks can see them, but so they don't float, tip over, and do exactly like you mentioned.
So I'm looking at a map here at the dashboard, drainage pump station status. I just want to get back to an inch an hour and a half an inch thereafter. If it rains an inch in Carrollton and none at all in New Orleans East, you can't expect, or rather if it rains 9 inches in Carrollton and an inch in New Orleans East, you can't expect Carrollton, it's going to be different, right? That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw that very thing on the 21st. We had a lot of rain across the city. We had, you know, upwards of 2 to 4 inches just about every place. But you look at Algiers, the lower Ninth Ward, and parts of New Orleans East. And when you take on 9-10 inches of rain over the course of 3 or 4 hours, that's going to be, you're going to end up seeing water stacking up in the streets and curb to curb level flooding. So it just, yeah, it depends. And that's, you know, Peyton Malone hit it on the head earlier. We know somebody in South Louisiana is going to get a lot of rain. We just don't know exactly who.
So let me talk about, if I can, Scott Walker said this, council member of Jefferson Parish, talked about water being in the streets. And I thought he made a good point yesterday, which is, and I know that's Jefferson Parish, but if it's in the streets and it's not in the house and it rains 9 inches, then you guys, in essence, have done your job, right?
Well, when the system is laid out for an inch an hour, I would much rather see it in the street, curb to curb, than getting up into lawns, into homes. Property damage is always something that should be avoided. It's something we don't want to see. But, yeah, water in the street and in the curb. If we get 9 inches of rain over a couple hours, that would be an outcome that you just can't avoid. That's the best you can hope for in those circumstances.
What is, do you guys, have you ever plotted, like, I know 9 inches is crazy, but I know it's an inch an hour on an average half an inch after that, but, like, where you get into trouble, a 3-inch zone, the 4-inch zone in an hour, Steve, or is it as simple as that?
It is more complicated than that, and it depends on the part of the city that you're in. So, for instance, New Orleans East is actually one of our most resilient areas because you've got more redundancy. If you really want to dive into it, there's a great book called Draining New Orleans that talks through some of that. But the short answer is there's not an easy or simple explanation, but it depends on the neighborhood.
Would there be a movie, Draining New Orleans? Because I'd much rather watch a movie than read the book. But maybe
someday.
It all depends on the elevation as well, right? I mean, water's going to seek its level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. So when I get reports of street level flooding, the first thing I'm checking is the intersection or the street or the property where the issue is. And then we have real-time data at our pump stations for canal elevations. And most of the time, the vast majority of the time, in fact, what I find is that the street elevation is above that of the canal, and water having the habit of flowing downhill. That generally indicates that it starts with that small diameter drainage and the canals and making sure those things are clear.
You know, it's hard to find an engineer with a sense of humor, but water having the habit of flowing downhill. Now, that's engineer comedy, my friend. Let me take a break. We'll do a tale of the pumps and the power and all that stuff when we come back. Tech comes in, is insanity, another major rainstorm coming. The city's doing the same thing, expecting a different result. I don't know what this texter wants anybody to do, because the city is below sea level, and that's just the way it is. A couple other people texting in, Steve, about how big of a problem it is with lawn care companies blowing grass into the drains. We'll talk about all that when we come back. 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Steve Nelson, General Superintendent, Surge Water Board of New Orleans. The water's got to get from the street into the drain. From there, it goes to the canal. Once it's in the canal, it has to be pumped out. The pump has to be powered in order to work. Steve, take it from there, please.
Yeah, you've captured it nicely. The system is all of that. It's catch basin, small diameter pipe, canal, and pumps. And all of those have to work in concert, and the pumps have to have power. And the pumps and the power to the pumps has been a key focus, and rightfully so, for the last probably 5 to 10 years. Ghassan Corbon, our previous executive director, had a major initiative to bring online a power complex project, which will be online this summer. It is well underway, and that's going to take us off of power generation from turbines, including Turbine 4, which is well over 100 years old, and get us into a situation where we have a dedicated feed from Entergy as opposed to using the surface grid, and brand new equipment that is going to allow us to power these pumps instead of using 15 different sources of power. Even when we get to 70 megawatts, it's very, very complicated, and it'll get us to a place where it's much simpler, it's redundant, it's new, and it's not a panacea, because all of those things work together, catch basins, laterals, canals, but it's going to address one of those really weak links with some of our power generation.
So going into this evening's event, first of all, do you coordinate with the Department of Homeland Security or whoever it is that says neutral ground parking is allowed, NOLA ready? Do they check with you, or is that their call? And how confident are you with manpower, electrical power, pumps, et cetera, turbines? You got everything you need to take care of whatever's wrong.
Yeah, so NOSEP, Colin Arnold's group, he and I have one another on speed dial. If something unusual happens, NOSEP will lift or change parking restrictions. That's their prerogative, but we do stay in close contact in advance of and during weather. As far as pumping and power goes, we've got 88 pumps up. The vast majority of our big pumps are up and running. And those that are not running, we're working to get those online by hurricane season this year. And then as far as power goes, we've got 51.5 megawatts available. Turbine 5 has been online since earlier this week. Then the frequency changers that we have already available, that's kind of our next line. And then the electromotive diesels, or EMDs, those have all been run through a series of tests, and they're ready to run. That will give us 51 megs, and we need 44 megawatts of power at peak demand. So I'm comfortable with the power status at present.
Thank you, Steve. Good luck. God help us all. We'll talk to Deuce when we come back. It's 9 minutes past 9 o'clock, and I suddenly realize that on my mantelpiece at home at the plush and fabulous Tucker Estate, I have two helmets, one an LSU helmet signed by Jamar Chase and a Saints helmet that is unsigned. But I can guarantee you this, as soon as he starts coming into the studio, that helmet's going to be signed by our next guest, if he doesn't mind, Deuce McAllister, WWL Saints color analyst and former Saints running back. How you doing, Deuce?
I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
I'm all right. You'll sign my helmet for me?
Yeah, that's not a problem at all. And I sneak into the studio more than you know. And so we just, you're the morning guy, and I'm normally the afternoon guy, so our paths don't cross as much.
I don't know. I left something for you a long time ago. I don't know if you've ever gotten it, have you?
Yes.
You did? Okay, all right, good. Just checking. Just making sure. All right. Let's talk about the Saints draft class. One thing that irritates me is when I see the pundits give them grades on a draft. And it's like, you know what? It's like Matthew McConaughey and what do you call him? Wolf of Wall Street. It's a wazzy, it's a woozy. Nobody knows how these guys are going to play out. How's it going to turn out? How can you actually give the draft class a grade? Is that crazy to you or not?
No, I get it. I understand it. It's kind of arbitrary as well, because you're basing it off of what you think, mm-hmm. not necessarily what the team thinks of that process. And it's based off of, you know, maybe I sell a subscription, maybe I took the time to do some rankings of those players, and based off of where they were taken, that's the opinion of, you know, maybe one writer or a group of writers. And, you know, it's to kind of drum up conversation, or at least to be able to say, hey, look, this is the perspective that we figure, but it's not obviously guaranteed. And, you know, in the game of football, you obviously have to have some talent, but you have to be able to come together, and, you know, injuries affect some of that, what happens. But to be able to say what a guy, it's a projection, but obviously that's just someone's opinion.
I'm going to skip ahead here to my opinion in round four. I saw Danny Stutzman play a couple of times, and I'm delighted that the Saints got this guy, and I think he could be a real contribution to the team. Thoughts?
Yeah, I really, when you look at the overall draft class, I think, you know, that's the hope, mm-hmm. from a lot of those guys. And you talk about how quick does that happen. It's really going to be up to the players and the coaches, you know, on how much they can comprehend, how quickly they can adapt to the speed and the adjustments that you have to make in the NFL. But really, I was somewhat surprised that you talk about, hey, we have X amount of picks, and we're going to make every one of them. And that's really, you know, and we're not going to trade future assets as far as to move up to get maybe a specific player. And that's really what the Saints were able to do. And, you know, a pretty good amount of that draft class, they will have every opportunity to make the 53-man roster and not just be a guy that goes to the practice squad. I mean, like I said, injuries will play some of a part in some of that, but at the same time, how quickly can they grasp the NFL game? And, you know, what's the position, or what's the idea for that player?
You've forgotten more about this than I'll ever know, but one thing I think that epitomizes the difference in the speed is that in college you might see a guy return a punt and turn a corner, or on a run turn a corner, and he gets away with speed. But in the NFL, everybody's almost that fast, right? I mean, that's the big difference between college and pro?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think it's the attention to details. I think it's the attention to details that a lot of times you don't have that in college, not as much. And, you know, you get guys that, hey, I can tell you based off alignment. I can tell you based off of down and distance. I can tell you based off of peer tendencies of what this guy's doing. And so in NFL, you don't have a lot of time to think. And if you don't have any pre-snap clues, mm-hmm. whether we're talking offense, defense, or even special teams, you're basically left to react. And nothing wrong with reacting, but at some point, that's going to get you beat just because you're reacting maybe a hair late and you're waiting for the play to develop when if I don't see that pitch or part of that picture before the snap, then, you know, yeah, some guys can get by with just pure reaction, but they're at some point it's going to catch up to them. And, you know, from a college standpoint, you have the limitations as far as how long you should be able to practice. You know, that's capped by the NCAA and how much time coaches can spend with them. Now, you know, they have analysts and some other guys that can help out in some of those situations, but for the NFL, I mean, a normal work day, even if you're not out on the field specifically, mm-hmm. Whether you're looking at film, whether you're breaking down some down and distance, different types of situations, that's really some of the bigger differences that you have in the NFL to college.
You know, I saw some stuff on social media, and it's all entertainment, I realize that, but it was Tom Brady and Shedeur Sanders and Deion Sanders, some out of Rolls Royce, and Tom Brady said that Shedeur Sanders needs to get his butt in a film room and watch tape and break it down. And the only reason I bring that up, Deuce, is how much of a difference is made, like when you leave, when a pro football player goes home, it's not over with, right? Or is it? Or do you bring that home and are you watching video and breaking stuff down and looking for any little competitive edge that you can, even though it's on your own free time?
Yeah, it's not over. Just because you've left the building, that doesn't mean that your work day is done. And I think the biggest thing is to have some balance with it. Mm-hmm. Even if you're only spending maybe 10 to 15 minutes, it doesn't have to be, hey, now I have to go and watch another 5 hours of film. No, I mean, the coaches, they do understand that you are a person as well, but there has to be some balance. And so, you know, maybe it's I'm going to spend 20 minutes a day, you know, throughout that day while I'm at home. It may be, you know, before I go to bed, I want to look at the next day install, or I want to look at third down package, or I want to look at goal line. So there's windows that you have throughout the day that you can just pick up some little stuff to be able to make sure that you're prepared either for that Sunday or even for the next day. I mean, because those coaches, once they put that installation in, they've got to know that you can do the job that you're being asked to do. And they're not going to have, let's say, hey, we got to run this play 10 times for you to get it right. Because probably after the third time, it's either going to get pulled completely or the player is going to get replaced as far as who's doing that job. And so if you're not comfortable or familiar with what they're asking you to do, depending on who it is and what it is, either that play is going to be pulled completely or that player that's being asked to do it is going to get replaced in doing that job. And so just because you leave the building, that doesn't mean that, oh, now I don't have to worry about this week's preparation anymore. I'm done until I walk back in the building the next morning. If that's what's happening, then you're kind of cheating yourself as well as your teammates.
You know what you know. You've done what you've done. You know what you're looking at. Can you watch a player and kind of pick out where it's like, you know, the average person doesn't know it, but I know that you should have known that? Like, kind of like I can listen to somebody on a radio and say, you know, the average person doesn't catch that, but I kind of know what you should have known. Do you get what I'm saying?
I do, but a little bit more goes into it because it may be a tendency breaker. And he may be asked to do something specifically different than what showed up on film. But if it is a tendency breaker, then the other 10 players, they should be doing what they are asked to regularly do on a play. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about maybe zone blocking, you know, maybe a different look or just some tendencies, or this is how this play has been run. This is how you've run this play 100 other times. But now this time you ran it different. It may be a tendency breaker. They may see something defensively where they put it out there and they want to just catch the eyes of one or two players to know that, hey, he's watched so much film. When he sees this play, he sees this step, this is what he does. So, yes, there may be a tendency breaker in there, but if it is, then the other 10 guys should be doing something completely different or how they've done it before. You can pick up some little stuff like that, mm-hmm. but it's based off of just film. It's based off of putting the work in before to be able to pick it up. And now, once I've seen it, okay, what's the counter to that play? What's the overall objective? Because if you're doing it and it's that play's still not working, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it. Maybe you should go back to the way you've done it all before. But there may be opportunities where teams will have some tendency breakers, but normally based off of what a team traditionally does and what they have shown on film, you can be able to pick up some little tendencies and be able to say, yep, that player messed up, or based off of how the other 10 guys were blocking or how they reacted to fill in a hole, this player X should have been there and he wasn't there.
All right, here we are, May 6th. I can't wait till it's Sunday afternoon and I got, or whenever the games, it's probably be Sunday afternoon this season, but I got Deuce and Haas and Jeff Nowak on the radio going on in the living room and I'm pacing up and down and listening, and Deuce, they did a great job last season with the games and the team. And when we come back, we'll go through the Saints draft class, Deuce, and talk about how they're likely to make a difference in the team and the games that you call this year that I listen to in my living room this year with the new dog, Teddy. 920, y'all got any questions? 504-260-1870. It's the Oakland Art Jeweler text line. I'll pass them along to Deuce when we come back on WWL. Deuce, false start. Deuce McAllister is spending some time with us. Y'all all know who Deuce is. And Deuce, I mentioned spending Sunday afternoons with y'all, I would imagine, and the schedule's going to be released on Wednesday, May 14th. It's usually just a terribly kept secret because it starts usually around a week ahead to leak out in dribs and drabs. You think most of the Saints games will be on Sunday afternoon this year?
No, I do think that the Saints will get a few Thursday, and you're probably looking at one to two Monday night or Sunday night game. Now, the only question is, are we going to be hosting it here in New Orleans? Mm-hmm. You know, that'll be the question. You know, more than likely you're going to be a visitor at least on two of those games, mm-hmm. In those situations. But I do expect the Saints to at least get, you know, one or two Thursday games and at least one Sunday night and or a Monday night game.
Well, I was with y'all all the way from Arizona on August 10th to Tampa Bay on January 5th. You called the games. Y'all did a great job. Tell me about the draft class this year. You can start with Kelvin Banks if you want. Tyler Shuck, keep going through the line. And who's likely to make a difference in the team that you call this year?
Well, when you look at the draft class, and, you know, really, Tommy, it's kind of like we talked about even previously. There are certain guys, and I don't want to kind of say, hey, this guy has to produce at this level to be successful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Banks is one of those guys that has to be able to produce at a high level for the Saints, and that's just because not necessarily just he was taken in the first round, but you want to solidify your offensive line, and so the Saints have to make the decision. You know, whether you know you talk about Banks is going to go to his natural position, and now I can flip my first rounder from last year over to his natural position, and when you do that, it gives you, I guess, you have your bookend tackles for the next 10, 12, 15 years, whatever it may be. And so whether Fuaga moves over to the left side or whether he stays, whether he goes back to the right side naturally or he stays on the left, that'll be up to the Saints to be able to kind of say, hey, this is what we're going to do. Any other player outside of Banks, and that's even with Tyler Shuck. Even with him, I'm not gonna throw him in the mix and say, hey, look, you're the day one starter. We know from the quarterback situation, whether that's Rattler, whether that's Derek Carr, what happens there, that's gonna be one amongst those guys and who's available. That's really, what's gonna happen in that situation. Every other player, I think they will have a role, so to speak. And what I mean by that, they may not be asked unless there's an injury. Now, injury obviously changes the whole situation for any of those guys. But no other really player will be asked to go in and be a day one starter. Now, there may be a package that he's a starter on, but I don't think that they're going to ask any other guy unless he just he takes that opportunity, and then that could happen. But I think everybody else, whether you're talking about your Sanker or Stutzman or Neal or even Diggs, I think all of those guys have an opportunity to be involved in a package, and then obviously special teams. That's where they're going to have to kind of make sure that they're active on game day because of that situation. And so I'm intrigued to see what other moves that this team does make, whether that's via trade or whether that's via the some guys maybe getting released here over the next couple of weeks because of the OTAs, because of mini camps, and some team is going to find out, hey, this rookie is ready to step in and have a bigger impact, and that's not just the Saints. So a veteran may be let go, and some guys are potential June 1st available from a cap standpoint, because now teams can you can spread that cap hit out over 2 years. And so the Saints are monitoring all of this. It's not anything new that I'm kind of telling, maybe from a different perspective, but we'll see how it all unfolds over the next couple of weeks, couple of months.
What do you think the offense is going to look like under Kellen Moore? Or can you even tell me, because it depends so much on the quarterback?
No, I don't think it. I think some of it depends on the quarterback, but not necessarily the basic principles of the offense. I don't think that necessarily depends on the quarterback. Let's just say you may call a little bit more quarterback runs in certain situations based off of this guy, one of the three or one of the four that you have available. I don't want to say that. From that standpoint, that may change a little bit, but and I would be remiss. Jake Haener is in the mix as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about him.
Yeah, Jake gets thrown out and kind of forgotten as well. I talked about the other three, but not Jake. Mm-hmm. I think that you have to put him in that mix as well. A lot of people kind of, he's been here a couple years and he hadn't done anything. Well, I would say all of them kind of get a fresh start when you have a new head coach that comes into the room. He doesn't have a working relationship with really any of you guys. And so for whether it's quarterback coach, whether it's the, OC, whether it's the head coach, they want to give you an opportunity for you to be able to go out there and show that what you can do. And that's for any of those quarterbacks that's in that room. And, it's kind of just see, hey, show me what you can do. And can you keep this offense together? Can you go out and put points on the board? And can we put a system or at least a game plan week in and week out that gives us a chance to win?
How do you think the offense is going to look different than last year?
Based off of what they said, mm-hmm. I mean, because that's all you can really go off of at this point. I think that you want to be physical. I mean, that's really any team. I don't think that you will have as much wide zone. I don't think that that's the basis of this offense. I think that you will still run some zone plays, but maybe not as much wide zones. And I think it'll be a little bit more downhill. Mm-hmm. So I've got to see it. Because right now it's just listening to the words of what they're telling me, and from a vertical standpoint, I still think that they'll play action, they'll throw the ball deep, but I still need to see it. So, whether we're based out of 12 personnel where you've got two tight ends out there the majority of the time, or they feel like, hey, 11 personnel with three receivers is our best personnel, we'll kind of have to see what direction they go in. And look, some of that will be based off of who's available, who's available for the Saints. You've got two of your better tight ends that have knee injuries. Mm-hmm. So do you want to say right now, you talk about Taysom and Foster, both of those guys, they've got knee injuries. So how can you say 12 is my best personnel when two of my better guys aren't available? And so it may be having to go with 21 with fullback in the game or 11 personnel with three receivers in the game. And so they'll figure a lot of that out. But like I said, injuries is going to play a determining factor as well.
Going back to Kelvin Banks, I think one thing that really hurt the Saints a lot is continuity when it comes to offensive linemen, because that is important. Deuce, talk about that, if you would, please, about having the same five guys in there.
Yeah, I think it's always important when those guys can be in there. They can be together. They can talk. They can, be able to maybe hear one word, maybe one phrase. And the guy in the middle, it starts with him. And, Eric McCoy, he will give off certain signals, he will give off certain signs, and, you know, from the guards to the tackles, they will pass it down. And so when you don't have to help any one particular lineman, then that's a offensive coordinator's or a head coach's dream, because from a quarterback's perspective, I know that all five guys, or, you know, if it's four rushers or whatever it may be, all of them are picked up. And from the protecting the quarterback, it starts there. Because if the quarterback isn't comfortable, there's really no offense that you can run, because my quarterback feels like everything is rushed. Everything, he's in a hurry. And so he's not comfortable in the pocket. He's flushed it. He's moving out of the pocket. Now my timing is off for every play that I run. And so when that is occurring, it's tough offensively, because now you can't find any rhythm. You can't, you know, move the ball consistently, and it's a free fall from there. And so if you can have continuity up front, with Eric being able to send out a word, send out a signal, send out, you know, a phrase, and all five guys understand, they know, they're moving in rhythm, they're able to play off one another, there's a game from the defense, they're able to pick it up, they're able to, you know, to pass it off and different things like that. It's beautiful. And so that's one of the things that helps when all five are available. And that just wasn't the case last year because of injuries.
When you talk about and somebody just texted me something that threw me off here. When you talk about the I lost my train of thought, Deuce. I can't believe it happened, but it did. It happens, right? What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Oh no, here you go. Here you go. I got it. When you talk about acquisitions and the time with June 1st and all of that stuff, is it depending on who's available, or are there specific positions you're looking at to improve?
Think a little bit of both. June 1st, you know, now teams can spread that cap hit out over 2 years. And so that's why June 1st is the date that you will have some players that become available, or some teams will make a trade or two for some players, because now teams can spread that cap hit out over 2 years. Now, I mean, from the you can still get creative on how you want to maybe a guy he's able to restructure his deal to the new going team, or, you know, the team that's trading him. They said, hey, you know, we will eat some of this salary, some more of this salary, if you give us a premium draft pick for next year's draft. All of that is on the table. I mean, and really, most teams will have had some type of OTAs, so they will have some idea of what they're looking for, but they will also know that, hey, we're maybe a player or two away at X position to really be able to say we can compete and get into the playoffs and make a run. But, you know, some teams will wait to once training camp starts,
right,
to say, I need to see when guys are in pads. Because, like, right now, and during OTAs and even the mini camp, the mandatory mini camp, you can't be in full equipment. So it's really an eye test. And at this point, all of them should look good. I mean, because you're just in shorts. Mm-hmm. So you should look fantastic in shorts, you know, but that changes a little bit when you put some pads on, and, you know, pad level plays a part, and how guys carry the pads, that's going to play a part. And so that will be a difference maker for some guys. But, you know, right now, every player should look good because you're just in shorts.
And if you had to name an X position for the Saints, what would you say?
Exposition as far
well,
as they've got to get better,
know, yeah,
or exposition.
Exactly, yeah, like a player or two away at exposition, what position would it be?
I mean, there's multiple, and this is just not the Saints, but there's multiple positions that they could add to maybe make that team a little bit better. Mm-hmm. There's not just one position for me. I mean, and so,
in essence,
you know, cornerback is one.
Yeah, and in essence, it would almost go to the player at that point, right? Because
well,
help.
I mean, I would love to add a veteran cornerback. I would love to add, you know, maybe a big receiver, a veteran big receiver to that room. I would love to add a tight end, another tight end to that room. And so, you know, there's always going to be things that you can go and get. Maybe another rush defensive end. You know, you add that to the mix. And so, but that's not just the Saints. That's probably every team that feels like they can get a little bit better. If not, but here's the thing, Tommy, is that type of player going to be available?
Mm-hmm.
And then, is my younger guy with more reps going to be able to step up, and maybe he can do the same thing if I can't get that elite player that I want. And then the other part of it is, what's the price tag? Mm-hmm. What is it going to cost me? Is it going to cost me draft picks, or is it going to cost me a tremendous amount of money as far as his salary that, you know, you've got to be able to pay?
I can't wait to watch it unfold. Thank you, Deuce. Look, next time you're here, check with the boss lady. I'm going to lead helmet with her, all right?
Fantastic.
Thank you, my
brother.
Friend.
You take care.
You too.
Be safe this week as well, and you tell our listeners to be safe with the weather that we got coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you, Deuce McAllister. Man, you're solid gold, solid black and gold. 9:39, we'll take a break, talk about tariffs on foreign films. When we come back, traffic now, WWL. Nine 14 till 10. Tommy Tucker, tell you what, we talk about it here, it happens there. We're talking to Jason Wagenspeck, president of Film Louisiana, about production going offshore and to other countries. And then the next day, President Trump talks about tariffing foreign films. So now Jason Wagenspeck joins us again, president of Film Louisiana. How you doing, Jason?
Good, Tommy. Thanks for having me back on.
Thanks for coming back on. So let's talk about, because, you know, we talked about it the other day, about just like any manufacturing process or production, it's you're making a product, which is, in this case, a film or a television program. You're telling me that it's, and you told me the other day that it's gone off overseas. I don't know how you go about determining, just like we talk about tariffs with a car, how the part crosses a border several times and it winds up in a vehicle. I don't know how, with a movie, you would determine what's foreign made and what's not. Do you know how they determine that now, Jason?
Well, I mean, look, with Trump's new announcement, we're all trying to figure out the details of all of this. And I am questioning the same thing that you just questioned. How do we determine what is going to be constituted as a foreign film at this time? And so it brings a lot of interesting conversation. I mean, as you and I alluded to, we just talked about this last week, how we are in desperate need of a federal film office to really have conversations around how we keep that business here and how we don't allow it to continue to run away.
You know, I think this would be a good chance to kind of go through the anatomy of a film, or how it comes to be, because, you know, we go and we watch, Tim tells me the number one movie this week is Sinners, that was filmed in Donaldsonville, I think, Louisiana, and going to the strength of Hollywood South. But it just doesn't happen, right? I mean, you got to have a concept. You got to have an idea. Take me through the movie making 101. How do we go from just, hey, let's make a movie about this, to having something that you can either show on a screen or stream or what have you?
Well, it is a long process. And that movie by Ryan Coogler, who came out with just a wonderful story, I say wonderful, but a wonderful piece of storytelling in the fact that he made a really fantastic movie. And obviously it's showcasing and doing well in the theaters right now. And so the process really comes from an idea. It's a spark, or maybe it's somebody else's spark in a book that you want to option, that you want to make into a movie. But those things take a long time, goes into development, figuring out the attachments, who's going to come and be a part of that project, finding the right director, finding the right stars, finding the right partners, whether it's you raising money on your own and making an independent film, or you going to a studio and having them financing that for you and finding a distribution model. It can take years. I know in my world, I mean, I've been working on some projects for a decade now that I know are going to be wonderful stories to be told, but it takes a long time to get those things to see to fruition.
So, you know, you're making widgets, so you got to get a factory, and you got to get the raw materials, and you got to have the market for it naturally. So you make your widget and then you sell them. When it comes to, and you got to buy the raw materials, and you got to invest the capital in making the equipment that produces the widgets and so forth, buying the equipment, I guess what I'm trying to get to, Jason, is when it comes to these financing models, when it comes to films, I guess that's why we see this production of that production and that production. They got 15 different production companies at the beginning of the movie.
Yes, essentially that's what it is. It's finding partnerships with companies that can add value to each of the pieces of the picture, whether it's bringing a star, whether it's bringing financing, whether it's bringing an element or an asset that helps get the movie made. It could be P&A, you know, which is print and advertising. It's also known as marketing. Mm-hmm. It could be many different levels. And so that's where you see all of those names on the front of the film and all those production companies that come with it.
So when it comes to the business part of it that's gone overseas, can you narrow it down to, is it the filming portion of it or is it the investment part of it?
Like I said, if we're going back to the announcements from this weekend, mm-hmm. I can't tell you what he's pinning down on it. I don't know if it's just the mere fact that it is in a foreign land outside the United States that he is going to try and place some sort of tariff or some sort of fee on that, or you're right, or if it's to be the financing of. The problem with that, with the financing of, is that, you know, there is financing that happens all around the world in partnership. I'm doing one right now with a Canadian company right now, a documentary that we're going to be working on. And so I have to question the same respect, like, what does this mean? I know we're shooting the majority of it here in Louisiana, but does that mean that because it has some financing from an international company, is it not allowed to be able to enjoy the domestic distribution here, or will I be tariffed on that? So I sit in that boat as well. But the one thing that we need to go back to is the conversation is being had right now mm-hmm. around driving film back to the U.S. And whether we like this announcement on Sunday or not, it is bringing the conversation up, which is the most important piece that we really need to see and understand how we can continue making these stories here. And I know there's a lot of people ready to go back to work to tell those stories here.
So, and along those lines, I guess we'll leave it at this. This was and I took it as a positive thing, at least as far as bringing production back to the United States and back to Louisiana. It would be a positive approach, I would think, at least.
Look, it would. You know, I can't say it would or it wouldn't because, again, we don't know all the details. But,
Right. Again,
we go back to the conversation being brought up that we have an issue. We know that production is running away. And then now let's sit at the table and figure out how do we keep it here. Does that mean a federal film office, like I mentioned earlier? Does that mean a federal film incentive? Or I don't know what his thoughts are around tariffs or how he actually, put a fee structure to that. So we still have a lot of details that need to be worked out. But the conversation is being had by one of the, you know, the biggest names in the United States. The president of the United States has brought this up. And so the conversation is now in the direction of finding ways to bring production back. And I think that is a positive thing in the direction that we need to go in.
That's what I was trying to say. You should be a storyteller. Oh, wait a minute. You are. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. Jason Wagner, you bet. President of Film Louisiana, 953, taking a break, finding out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.